since we were in the Song of Solomon, taking us a long, long time to get through. I think we're at the end of chapter 2 and the beginning of chapter 3. And the fact that there's no real continuity in our studies is making things perhaps a little bit more difficult. As I've pointed out, each Bible study, there are difficulties in deciding who is actually speaking. And we've decided more or less to follow the headings that are given in the New International Version. That's a fairly good guide. I've been reading the IVP commentary on the Song of Solomon, and Mr. Still's notes on the Song of Solomon, and my brother's notes on the Song of Solomon. And especially the latter two, the commentary gets me lost in a lot of technical details at times. The other two, the Daily Bible Reading Notes, both these reverend gentlemen bring out wonderful spiritual lessons, which I've loved reading. But I'm not just too sure that all these lessons are actually in the book that's called The Song of Solomon. What we're going to read tonight has some figures of speech, some descriptions that really seem rather odd to lots of us. Some of the descriptions from the lover of the girl that he's in love with really make you chuckle. But you've got to remember that in the culture that they are in, these illustrations are really very vivid. I found myself thinking, don't think as any, well, Willie Young's almost an Aberdonian, George Chalmers is not here, but those who know anything about Aberdeen know that there's lots of very, very broad language, and but some marvellously descriptive phrases. And I remember, I'm not sure if it was my mother or someone else describing someone. In Aberdeen, you don't speak about a pocket. You don't even speak about a pouch. You speak about a pooch. And either my mother or somebody else described a certain person as having a face like a torn pooch. Now, you must admit, that's vivid. Well, Glasgow's got greeting-faced. Now, we'll read some very, very vivid. I mean, there are not many people here who would like their hair described as a flock of goats. But wait a minute, but it's a marvellous illustration. It's a very complimentary description when you understand it. Now, I'm saying this just now so that we won't get totally lost when we're reading it. What the exact circumstances are here in the Song of Solomon is really not clear. Sometimes I read and I think, no, they're not married. They're engaged, but they're not married. At other times, the language seems to suggest that they are married, and if they aren't married, they shouldn't be saying the kind of things that they're saying. Now, it's difficult. But one thing is absolutely clear, and I think we've found this in our three earlier studies. This book that we call the Song of Solomon is all about love in its truest sense. It's about two people who are not just attracted to each other, because attraction can simply be eros or erotic, and very little more to it than emotional come physical reaction. Not just attracted. These two people, and we will see this, these two people are drawn to each other. And the woman, the Shulamite woman, remember she described herself in the early chapter as black but comely. The thing that draws her to this lover is that she becomes aware of the astonishing love that he has for the likes of her. Now see, this is the gospel we said. This is in our opening prayer. Behold, this is what we come to in 1 John for our communion service tomorrow morning. Behold, what manner of love the Father hath bestowed upon us, So in love they are drawn to each other, and they are committed to each other, and they express their love verbally. And remember, in our last study we were emphasizing that point. It's no use us saying, so-and-so, they know that we love them. Or they should know by now that we love them, of course. But then you see, it's got to be expressed. And according to the Bible, love that is not expressed both verbally and practically is suspect. And they express their love. They say how they feel. And a lot of us are very, very reluctant to say that at times. Quite often recently I've said to people, how are you? They say, oh, fine. And I said, tell me the truth. And they say, well, it's been a difficult week. And then, isn't there one of the Ten Commandments that says, you shall not bear false witness? They express their love. They say how they feel. They say quite openly how they react to certain situations. I think in the passage tonight it seems that for some reason or other the lover is away, and the poor lass dreams all night about searching for him everywhere and not being able to find him. That's how she felt. She was bereft of the one for whom her heart cried out. And reading and studying, I think we found this in our Saturday Bible studies, and I've certainly found it in studying this book at home. Reading and studying turns our hearts to the love of Jesus for us. And we are taught that even though we not only feel unworthy, but are unworthy, he wants us. Now that's important. He wants us. And this brings us to where we finished our last study. Some of you will remember the last two verses of chapter 2. My lover is mine, and I am his. He browses, or it could read, I think the RSV has it better, he pastures his flock among the lilies. Until the day breaks and the shadows flee, turn, my lover, and be like a gazelle or a young stag on the rugged hills. If I remember rightly, we quoted at the end of our Bible study that night from the hymn, I Found a Friend, or Such a Friend. For I am his, and he is mine, forever and forever. And in these last two verses of chapter 2, the picture may be of an intimacy of relationship which comes when you feel secure in someone's love. When you are sure of someone's love, you can be yourself. You don't have to hide anything. And I think that is the picture there. There may be the element of it, there's a tenderness in verse 16 and it goes on to about gazelles and young stags on the rugged hills. There may be a mixture in these two verses of tenderness on the one hand and strength on the other. And these are two of the basic elements of love. Tenderness and strength. There also may be, as some of the commentaries suggest and some of the notes suggest, some indication here of preserving the privacy of a true relationship of love. There's a lot just now in writing and in visual image and verbal and radio, visual and television, that is supposed to be about love. But it's brash. It's vulgar. It makes public that which is essentially private. And one thing that love will always be is seemly. It's an old-fashioned word. We've got it in the old hundredth that we'll be singing tomorrow. For it is seemly so to do. The old folk up in Aberdeenshire used to speak critically of some people, saying that, oh, they've no sense of the fitness of things. Now you see, in the realm of love, there are some things that are private. There are other things that rightly and legitimately can be expressed publicly. But when that which is essentially private and intimate becomes brash and public, something has gone wrong with the love. Love will always behave itself. Love will always respect the loved one. And love will always curb its own particular inclinations, however difficult, rather than embarrass or harm the loved one. Now you see, this Song of Solomon in many ways is a love poem, and there's a lot to learn from it about the human relationship of love. Let alone that wonderful relationship of love between Christ and his church. And so we turn over into chapter 3 and we read the first 5 verses. All night long on my bed I looked for the one my heart loves. And as I say, it's best to think of this as a dream. Otherwise it could easily slide into the erotic, which I'm sure it's not meant to do. So think perhaps for some reason the lover to whom she knows that she belongs and wants to belong for some reason is absent. He's gone away for some reason. All night long on my bed I looked for the one my heart loves. I looked for him but did not find him. I will get up now and go about the city, through its streets and squares. I will search for the one my heart loves. So I looked for him, but did not find him. The watchmen found me, as they made their rounds in the city. Have you seen the one my heart loves? She asks. Scarcely had I passed them, when I found the one my heart loves. I held him, I grasped him, and would not let him go till I had brought him to my mother's house, to the room of the one who conceived me. Daughters of Jerusalem, I charge you by the gazelles and by the does of the field, do not arouse or awaken love until it so desires. That last verse, amongst other things, means don't play around with people's affections. It is cruel and it makes God angry. But what are we to make of these verses? As I say, possibly a dream. And she dreams that she's gone out to search the city for her loved one. And then eventually finds him. And the language seems to suggest she compels him to come back with her. There are times when the lover must go. But then you see, that does not break the relationship. I know it's very trite to say that absence makes the heart grow fonder. There's a lot of truth in it, if the love is really love. Remember in one of our early studies, I quoted what I'd heard my brother saying in one occasion. Sometimes a person says, I love you, but what they really mean is, I love me and I want you. That's a very different thing altogether. But where love is real, absence or separation does not break the relationship, but what it does do, it increases the longing. Now think of this the next time we sing, is it hymn 459, Thou Hidden Love of God. My heart is pained, nor can it be at rest, till it finds rest in thee. And sometimes when we have drifted from the Lord, and that we are not walking with him in the way that we once did, there can come upon mind and heart and spirit a wistfulness to be back with Jesus. Possibly some of the commentators suggest in these first five verses that the young woman is recalling what her lover said to her in chapter 2, verse 10. My lover spoke and said to me, Arise, my darling, my beautiful one, and come with me. Oh, and she wants to do it more than anything else. And she goes to search. And there's something almost frantic about her in this dream. It's difficult to know how to expound this kind of thing, you see. Should she have wanted to go searching for him, as she did in the dream? Or should she have waited in trust, knowing that the one who loved her would not stay away one moment longer than necessary? Now you see, in Christian life and for our spiritual growth, there are times that the Lord moves away from us, and we don't have the sense of his presence. And we begin to, has he given me up? And we, when I think of all the bad things I've done, I wouldn't blame him if he did give me up. Now you see, his love is such. We'll sing about it at the end of our Bible study. Oh, love that wilt not let me go. I find that an immense comfort. That love will not let me go. So I don't know if the girl should have gone seeking for her lover or waited in trust. But when we come to verse 4, scarcely had I passed the watchman when I found the one my heart loved, and I held him. One commentary suggests it could almost read, I seized him and would not let him go. And I forget which of the notes, I think it was Mr. Still's notes, he suggests that there seems to be almost a note here of the lover's reluctance to go back with her. Now, of course, if they are not married, this would be understandable. But we don't know. There's no doubt at all that it would be necessary and good for the lover to be absent for a season. But there's a suggestion here in verse 4, I held him, I seized him, I wouldn't let him go. You know the kind of, you must come. You must. You know, we do it ourselves, don't we? I don't know how you react, but when people begin to say, you must. But to me, he says, but why must I? Sometimes if I popped in to see someone and I'm strictly in a hurry, and I go, you must stay. Now, there may be this kind of suggestion here. I think the whole of the book of Song of Solomon is supposed to be a mirror so that we can see ourselves. Not as others see us, but as the Lord sees us. And if there is reluctance here, I'm not sure if there is or not, but if there is reluctance here on the part of the lover as she seems to be dragging him back home is the reluctance due to the fact that there was beginning to emerge in the relationship something that could spoil it. Now, relationships are a very precious gift from God. But they are a gift from God, and they have to be stewarded as such. And the devil being the devil, he will always try to unbalance or overshadow or misdirect a God-given relationship. And the reluctance here might have been because of that. And I suppose we could draw a lesson from what I'm saying in terms of the fact that sometimes a break in a relationship is necessary, so that the two people stand back a bit from the relationship in order that they might see it more clearly and make sure that there is nothing in the relationship that is overbalancing. You see, love draws. Love doesn't compel. Sat and ponder. When you're preparing to do a Bible study in the Song of Solomon, you often sit and ponder and just think and think and think. I found myself thinking of the hymn that says, I need thee, oh, I need thee, every hour I need thee. And doesn't that hymn go on to say, temptations lose their power when thou art nigh? Isn't that true? Let's read on. We're getting into the really difficult bit now. Verse 6. And it's very difficult really to know who's speaking. I know that the heading in the NIV, it's still the lover, still the girl who's speaking. But it says here in verse 6, who is this? The RSV has, what is this? Well, there's obviously somebody or something coming. Who is this coming up from the desert like a cloud of smoke? Well, if it's chariots and procession, then coming through the desert, there'll be a cloud of dust. Who is this coming up from the desert like a column of smoke, perfumed with myrrh and incense, made from all the spices of the merchant? Look, it is Solomon's carriage, escorted by 60 warriors, the noblest of Israel, all of them wearing the sword, all experienced in battle, each with his sword at his side, prepared for the terrors of the night. It's really King Solomon and the household cavalry escorting him to his marriage. That seems to be the picture. Notice I said, that seems to be the picture. King Solomon, verse 9, made for himself a carriage. He made it of wood from the Lebanon. Its posts he made of silver, its base of gold, its seat was upholstered with purple, its interior lovingly inlaid by the daughters of Jerusalem. Come out, you daughters of Zion, and look at King Solomon wearing the crown with which his mother... Now, I've no idea what this means. The king would normally be crowned by the high priest. So what this crown is, I don't know if it's a particular garland or something, according to the custom for someone going to be married. The crown with which his mother crowned him on the day of his wedding, the day his heart rejoiced. Now, I feel like saying, who would like to expound that particular passage? It's obviously a royal procession. And the language here is extravagant language. And it should make us think of words spoken by Jesus when he spoke about Solomon in all his glory. That's what we've got here. Yes, but you see, what does it mean? Well, as I said earlier at the beginning of the Bible study, some find all sorts of spiritual messages and types and allegories and this and that and the other. And if you have Mr. Stills or my brother's notes and Solomon, they're just not all that very long ago, then you read them and I'm sure you'll be blessed with these notes. Whether you will understand verses 6 to 11 more, I'm not quite sure. I have no regret at studying these notes. It's difficult sometimes to know the exact connection between verses 1 to 5 and verses 6 to 11. Possibly, if verses 1 to 5 speak of the woman having found her lover, verses 6 to 11, she sees her lover in all his glory. Now, I suppose we could say, we have found Jesus. Jesus, lover of my soul, let me to thy bosom fly. But we have yet to see him in all his glory. Oh, you say, but Mr. Lewin, we know the Lord Jesus better now. Well, I hope you do. After all the times we've read the Bible together and prayed together and worshipped together and sung some of these marvelous hymns together, we should know him better. But when we shall see him as he is, that helps us to understand what these God-given points like Charles Wesley was getting at when he says, speaks about casting our crowns before him, lost in wonder, love, and praise. Peter speaks about Jesus, whom, having not seen, we love. But oh, when we see him as he is, this seems to be what's happening here. She sees her lover as the king above all kings. And the picture here is of him coming for her. She sees this magnificent royal procession. And her heart says, he's coming for me. A long time since we sang the children's hymn, when he cometh to make up his jewels. That's from Malachi or Haggai. I'm not quite sure which the illustration really comes from. He's coming for me. And that's why I emphasize in verse 10, not just the vehicle of his coming, but the whole ethos or pattern or nature of his coming, in its interior, lovingly inlaid. The work that went into this marriage carriage. Oh, the personal caring. I know what my daughter felt like when yon whopping great pale grey limousine arrived to take her to church for her wedding. Well, amplify that, enlarge that. And she watched this procession and this chariot coming. He's coming for me. This made me think of what I was speaking with Ella Randall about. I go to prepare a place for you. And I suppose what we have to see in all this and to feel in all this is the love he had for the one who was the object of that love. And of course, the love of Christ for his church. Oh, we've got to read it. I can't quote it from memory. Ephesians chapter 5. at verse 27. We've got the first part in verse 25. Christ loved the church, and he'll come to gather all his people to himself. And when he gathers us, oh, what an awareness we'll have of his love. We'll say, oh, Jesus, I didn't know you loved me like this. Christ loved the church and gave himself up for her, that he might sanctify her, having cleansed her by the washing of water with word, that he might present the church to himself in splendor, without spot or wrinkle or any such thing, that she might be holy and without blemish. When we sing the hymn, "There is a city bright," it's at the end verse that speaks about us faultless and stainless, safe in that happy land. That is the objective of this redeeming, seeking, forgiving, keeping love that he showers upon us without qualification. I suppose, in one sense, and some of the commentaries point this out, we should be thinking here of what we sing sometimes in our communion service, the Lamb's great bridal feast of bliss and love. Sometimes after a communion service, morning or evening, some folk will say to me, oh, it was just wonderful at the Lord's table. Oh, that's nothing compared to the wonder of the Lamb's great bridal feast of bliss and love. And we haven't really time to go into all the wonderful illustrations at the beginning of chapter 4. Because there you will notice the heading, "The Lover Begins to Speak." Jesus begins to speak to you and me. And it is the language of love. It's not in any sense flattery. This is how he thinks of us. And the detail in this description in verses 1 to 7, the details are such that it is quite obvious that this man we call the lover misses nothing when he looks at the one he loves. We're applying it spiritually, whether he's speaking of the individual believer or speaking of the church, it's difficult to know whether to start or just to forget about it till next time. You look down to verse 9, which is beyond what we're supposed to be going tonight. "You have stolen my heart." It's astonishing, isn't it? That the Son of God should say that kind of thing to the likes of you and me. Look at the language. "How beautiful you are, my darling. Oh, how beautiful. Your eyes." Oh, you can tell so much from my eyes. "Not least modesty. How beautiful. Your eyes behind your veil are doves. There is a gentleness." Then the one I was telling you, "Your hair is like a flock of goats descending from Mount Gilead." Ah, but you see, it's undulating slopes. The sun is shining, getting towards evening, and the black-haired goats coming down. You see the picture? It's jet black wavy hair. That's what he's describing. You know how sometimes at this time of year you look out of your window getting towards Tietam. Oh, look at the sky. Well, that's here. He's trying to tell her what she looks like to him. These jet black, long, wavy hair. Your teeth are like a flock of sheep just shorn. Nothing mucky or dirty about them. Coming up from the washing, each has its twin. Not one of them is alone. It's a perfect set of teeth. Pure white. And you can't help thinking that this man has spent a long time looking at his girl, hasn't he? The next verse, well, it depends whether or not you like lipstick. I don't. Your lips are like a scarlet ribbon. Your mouth is lovely. Ah, but you see, a mouth can tell a lot about a person. Ever notice how hard some people's mouths are? Aye, and how cold some people's eyes are when you're speaking to them. You know, nice to see you, Mr. Philip. You can feel the two daggers coming out. Well, when you've been in the ministry a long time, you don't bother too much about that. You just try to turn on a little extra charm. Your temples behind your veil are like the halves of a pomegranate. I've no idea what that means. Your neck is like the Tower of David, built with elegance. Now, nobody knows just which Tower of David they're speaking about, but one of the commentators, I think one of the very old commentators, says that the language, we could understand this best by thinking of perhaps looking onto a lake or a loch and seeing some pure white swans with the curve of their neck. Grace and elegance. Oh, you say, but we're not like this. No. We're all sinners. We're all spoiled. But when he looks upon us, the Son of God who bled and died to save us and to have us, when he looks on us, he sees us like this. It's almost unbelievable. But that's what it says. Your neck, like the Tower of David, built with elegance, on it hang 1,000 shields, all of them shields of warriors. It may be some gorgeous necklace. Your two breasts are like two fawns, like twin fawns of a gazelle that browse among the lilies. I think the whole picture is one, really, of rightful glamour and attractiveness. As far as he's concerned, she really is a beauty. Until the day breaks and the shadows flee, I will go to the mountains of Myrrh and to the... Now, I don't quite know what this means. Some suggest that it breaks off here and that this sixth verse is actually the girl speaking again. And she's listened to all that he's saying and... Oh, she... I think it's not just that she's feeling all modest. She's feeling a bit embarrassed and she wants to sort of go away and hide for a wee while. I don't know. But he breaks in again in verse 7. All beautiful you are, my darling. There is no flaw in you. Verse 9. You have stolen my heart. How, verse 10. How delightful is your love. How much more pleasing is your love than wine. And on it goes. You see, he wants her. Verse 8, come with me, my bride. Come with me. Come with me. Do you see, that's what Jesus is always saying to us. Come with me. Because he loves us. And he wants. Can I give you one verse? We've overshot our time. Turn over to John chapter 17 for this one verse. I'll do my very best not to say anything at all about it. John chapter 17 at verse... I've turned over to the Acts of the Apostles. That's the wrong place. John chapter 17 at verse 24. The end of Jesus' great high priestly prayer. Father, I desire... This is what I really want. Says the Son of God to his Father. Father, I desire that they also whom thou hast given me may be with me where I am, to behold my glory which thou hast given me in thy love for me before the foundation of the world. Father, this is what I really want. That these folk in the prayer meeting in Sandy for tonight will be with me and with you. And if that doesn't touch your heart and make you want to pray, I don't know what will. Let's take time to sing our hymn.